Anti-fascism seems to be ignored, and there's a discomfort with the word fascism. My approach has been to talk about elements of fascist politics. The Republican Party, for example, is consolidating the elements of a fascist party. They are not opposed to undermining democracy to get their one-way view out there. My purpose was to get educators who perceive themselves as progressive to speak out and acknowledge what is happening in their communities, in their state legislatures, and nationally, and not to wish it away. I think that's our real challenge, is to try to get the general public to see what is going on all around us.
Welcome to episode 158 of the Refuse Fascism podcast, a podcast brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Coco Das, one of those volunteers and guest host of the show while Sam Goldman takes some much-needed time off. Refuse Fascism exposes, analyzes, and stands against the very real danger and threat of fascism coming to power in the United States. In today's episode, we're sharing an interview Sam Goldman did with Dr. Michael Vavras, author of the book Teaching Anti-Fascism, A Critical Multicultural Pedagogy for Civic Engagement. But first, thanks to everyone who goes the extra step and rates and reviews the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you appreciate the show and want to help us reach more people who want to refuse fascism, be a gem and go write a review and drop 5 stars wherever you listen to your pods. Here are 2 from this week as proof we read every one. Sam14017198 said, covers the most important topics, conversations you don't hear on mainstream media, important, intelligent topics with great guests, makes you think and want to get engaged. Well, thanks, Sam. And here's one from YouTube, from @KathySChow4266. Love Refuse Fascism. Go, Sam. Interesting episode. My blood pressure spikes when folks like Aiken start picking apart the current thread. And almost say that Dems and fascist repubs are really the same, because capitalism? I know we've all heard it many times before, but 2024 really is the doomsday election. I'm a pessimist about voting, now that the fascists are suppressing votes at every level in every way possible. But I still think it's vital to do whatever we can to crush the extremists in 24, to overwhelm them with enormous numbers of sanity votes. So I think it's going to be super important to make young voters feel that urgency. Also, I want to know what we can do at the community level to disrupt the normalization of fascism. Please give us some specifics. Is it time to demonstrate in the streets outside our county GOP offices? Also, does anyone rally anymore? I feel like people are more afraid now to gather in protest of anything because guns and hatred. How do we throw a wrench into the fascist onslaught? How do we find help in doing that? Well, Kathy, there are a lot of good questions in that comment, and I'm going to try to address some of them in my commentary. But what do you all think? Send us your thoughts with the contact information I provide at the end of the show. And please tell the people out there in podcast land why you listen and why they should too. Subscribe and follow so you never miss an episode. And of course, keep up all that great commenting and sharing on social media. Now, as usual, in these times we're living in, there is a lot to talk about regarding the accelerating fascist threat in this country, especially around the powder keg 2024 election and the fascists going all out to seize back power by hook or by crook. This week marked the official start of the contest between Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump for top dog fascists, or to the bottom of the fascist cesspool, however you want to look at it, with the aim of re-seizing the White House in 2024, and terrifyingly consolidating and enslaving genocidal violence and vengeance-fueled program against everyone they hate. Everyone. Women, black people, immigrants, trans people, gay people, Democrats. DeSantis's threat to make America Florida, to institute an all-out blatant dictatorship to suppress any education, thought, speech, or action that tells the truth about the history of this country, that embraces diverse communities, that separates church and state, that allows women to participate fully in society or sees any of these people as fully human, is bringing a proven track record in a fascist laboratory to the national stage. He is positioning himself to the right of Trump, but it's clear that they will attempt to outdo each other in sheer lunacy, bigotry, and fascist lies. Now, DeSantis tried to innovate by collaborating with Elon Musk to bypass traditional media and make his announcement on Twitter Spaces. Plagued by technical difficulties, this ended up being an embarrassing failure. But had it succeeded, the press, which DeSantis was trying to eliminate from the conversation, might have been talking about how clever the idea was, about how DeSantis really figured out a key way to reach the demographic of rabid Christian fascists, election deniers, white supremacist anti-LGBTQ women-hating Republicans who want a seemingly saner and more competent version of Trump. But this is not a contest of buffoon against buffoon. It's a contest of fascist against fascist, both getting airtime, both advancing a truly hateful vision of society in which everyone must cower to the dictates of white supremacist Christian fascist men. Quoting an article in The Economist, quote, DeSantis may wind up as just another speed bump under Trump's relentless wheels. But more than any other Republican, he has extracted a coherent agenda from the jumble of Trumpian fears and hostilities, pointing the way towards a Trumpism without Trump. There were other news items to pay attention to this week. Most notably, the Indiana Attorney General's months-long harassment of Dr. Caitlin Bernard has come to a head. Dr. Bernard performed an abortion on a 10-year-old rape victim after Roe fell and spoke out about it, not revealing any confidential patient information, but courageously shining a light on the cruelty of abortion bans. As Jessica Valenti wrote about this case, quote, AG Todd Rokita has been using the power of his office to harass and punish Dr. Bernard under the guise of caring about the girl's privacy. Incredible for someone who wants to force a 10-year-old to give birth to argue that the doctor who treated her is somehow the issue. Now the Indiana Medical Board, disingenuously ruling that Dr. Bernard violated her patient's privacy, slapped her with a $3,000 fine. It wasn't a total victory for the Attorney General. He didn't succeed in getting her medical license revoked, for example. But it is still a checkmark in the fascist playbook. Another mechanism for silencing and shutting down any opposition to or defiance of fascist dictates. With that, let's hear Sam's interview with Michael Vavras.
I am excited to speak with, to welcome on to the show, Dr. Michael Vavras. He's a professor emeritus at the Evergreen State College. He teaches interdisciplinary courses focused on the intersection of education, history, and political economy. And his latest book is titled Teaching Anti-Fascism, A Critical Multicultural Pedagogy for Civic Engagement. Welcome, Michael. Glad to be with you.
Thank you for having me.
Can you first tell us a little bit about your book and what motivated you to write it in this moment?
I hadn't been planning to write the book, was reading a lot, preparing for teaching. And then as things begin to culminate with actions around the border, January 6th, I decided to go forward with this and was able to get an academic press that would support it. There just was a confluence of events happening. Misogyny, the militarization of the border, the larger society, demonizing of immigrants, other countries. And it just seemed like it was coming together in a fascistic way that traditionally the way critical multicultural education is presented, it wasn't really capturing that. So I thought that we really needed to dolly back a bit and look at what's going on in the United States and globally from an anti-fascist perspective that would allow multicultural concepts, cosmopolitanism, et cetera, to be voiced under that. I found multicultural education per se as a discipline limited in the way it approached issues. There wasn't the interconnectedness. There is intersectionality is widely used, but it doesn't really get to the larger issues, especially around political economy is what I had observed. So I wanted to push forward with that and also thinking deeply about genocide and what that can mean. All of those events coalescing in my mind just had me go forward with the book.
For listeners who aren't in the education field, how can they understand the difference between what multicultural education is and the robust anti-fascist education that you're advocating for? What might be some examples that could help people understand the difference?
Progressive multiculturalism often deals with what's called culturally responsive teaching, and it reduces what's going on in the classroom to cultural differences, acknowledging those. Those are all very positive, but it doesn't really give a historical political context of why are all these differences in the classroom? Why are some children marginalized in their communities? All of these issues that affect the classroom are overlooked. In academia, there's studies after studies of replicating. It's kind of like new studies in old wine bottles. Anti-fascism seems to be ignored, and there's a discomfort with the word fascism. My purpose was not so much aimed at those who understand in the way those who subscribe to refuse fascism, but to get educators who perceive themselves as progressive to move a bit more to the left and speak out and acknowledge what is happening in their communities, in their state legislatures, and nationally, and not to wish it away. We can do the best teaching possible, but there's these outside forces on the schools that I don't believe are well acknowledged.
I really agree. And I think that's an extremely helpful way of looking at it. I was thinking about some of the terms that we use broadly in society and that educators use in their classroom as well, whether you're talking about at the high school level or at the college level, words that aren't very helpful. For example, the euphemistic word like extremism. It means so many things that it means nothing. That word you can see in headline after headline and in course after course and hear it in the classroom. But the word fascism is barely seen in any opinion page and seems to be basically outlawed in the news itself. And I was wondering, how does that affect our society when we don't use the words that speak to actually what we face? And how do you think we get past that?
A little antidote here. I was talking to some people who are not involved in education, who would vote Democratic, let's say. I said, oh yeah, I don't watch the news because it's all either left extremists or far right extremists. My comment was, left, what are you talking about? I haven't seen that on the mainstream news, especially about the left. And she answers, oh, you know, on the left is the government and on the far right is these neo-Nazis. So I was nearly speechless because from this individual's perspective, oh yeah, the government is the left. And I thought, oh my gosh. And also I think the barriers to get to what you're talking about, you've got TikTok, you've got Instagram, you've got social media influencers that are not paying attention to any of this. I think the task is huge for the left to break through this miseducation, wishing this is not going to happen, not believing the fascist politics and creep that we see right now that's happening, and operating in some kind of bubble. My approach has been to talk about elements of fascist politics, it seems to have some traction in the sense that if you say fascism, people go, oh, wait a second, Mussolini, Hitler. Well, that's true. But we don't have fascism in the U.S. is what the response is. So I've tried to make it more of a wedge to say, well, let's look at the elements of what we would call the far right today. Let's look at the elements of the Republican Party. I'm currently working with graduate students. Initially, so many of them said, well, I just don't like politics. I haven't followed politics. Some are right there with it, but many just do not see that the political nature of schooling and what they're entering. In some regards, my own teaching with them burst that little bubble. I say, my goal is for you to go into your teaching, your schools with your eyes wide open. And there has been a movement, but it takes a considerable amount of time to move folks in that direction. So that's why I break it down to fascist politics. When I use extremism, it's more like, okay, if the mainstream wants to play that game, we'll play it with the far right. But I do agree with OAC, for example, when she says, oh, you think this is extremist? Okay, here's what I'm proposing. You know, and usually the politics are to benefit the average person, and that's being called extremist. I mean, the language that's used to describe what's going on is inflammatory. The far right is very good at that. Trump talking about pink-haired commies in schools and other Congress critters talking about, you know, the Marxist influence in elementary schools. You say that to a classroom teacher and they're going, what are they talking about? Since the 1980s, for sure, with Nation at Risk, when suddenly, uh-oh, something's wrong with education. It becomes a national whipping post, so to speak, education. It's in crisis. So if you keep saying it's in crisis enough, then people begin to say, oh, it's really bad. We need to do something about it. It's part of a long term to privatize education. I like to break it down into elements of fascism and fascist politics rather than just saying fascist. Although I do feel that the Republican Party, for example, is consolidating the elements of a fascist party. They just don't have total control. It's not a fascist regime yet. Personally, I feel that way. But for public groups that I address, other colleges, students, and the like, I tone it down in the sense because there's almost a knee-jerk reaction like, oh, fascist, that's too inflammatory. To bring people along, I use fascist politics and the elements there.
What are the key elements of that fascist politics that people need to understand?
I could go back to the mid-20th century and see how it parallels in a 21st century version. I find that helpful. Obviously, it's not exactly history repeating itself. There's not going to be a mirror image. But one in particular is the whole, what I call cultural racisms based on people's religion, ethnicities, phenotype racism based on physical features, skin color, hair shape, and all of that. You had that with the Aryan Nation, for example, in Nazi Germany. Today, we have white supremacist nationalism. I see that as a central gravitating point for far-right Republicans are going around this. So within white supremacist nationalism, you have the neo-Confederate sense of the lost cause. What is it that they think they're losing? They're losing white dominance from their perception because of our increasingly multicultural population in the United States. The people become racialized. This is a white nation. This is a Christian nation. The Christian identity movement and how that intersects with all of that. Evangelical Christians in their patriotism and anti-woman, we'll just say, notion or submissive women approach. And then from the French aristocrat, whose last name, unfortunately, is Camus, is the great replacement theory that's been picked up that, immigrants and people of color are going to replace the white population. So this white anxiety that one could trace back to the eras of slavery, this fear that Blacks are going to retaliate against whites. Well, why is that? There's probably good reason for the treatment that's gone on, especially of our Black and brown populations. So feeding into white supremacist nationalism is this sense of anti-government sentiment and demonizing government, that if things don't go the way we want it, so to speak, then there's violent alternatives. We saw that on January 6th. We see the National Republican chairwoman legitimizing it by calling that day a legitimate political discourse, the violence on that day. Trump at his rally plays music from those who have been incarcerated from January 6th and says he'll pardon them and frames them as patriots. We have tens of millions of people who are gravitating to that point of view and think, yeah, that's right. They were just tourists that day, so to speak, at the Capitol. And this notion of ethno-nationalism is nothing more than wanting an apartheid state, more than it already is. Then what I refer to as misogynistic post-feminism, that notion that somehow the gains of women have gone too far and that feminism really didn't benefit the larger society. Therefore, we need to stop those gains. We've gone too far, and women just need to support men. That is so central to the far right and fascistic politics. It was in the mid-20th century. It is today. Women are supposed to play supporting roles. That doesn't mean there aren't some, like Representative Green out there. There are women, and we can think about Sarah Palin, who played right into the misogyny by telling folks to man up. So women too can play this misogynistic role. So when I say misogynistic, it's this hate of women, it's violence against women. We see this with the incels, involuntary celibates, who feel that they've been thwarted in their sexual entitlement by women. And so this hateful speech that now is on social media, easily one can find this now. It's rampant. So these folks have places to go to express their misogynistic points of view, or like happened in Atlanta a few years ago, go in and just simply murder Asian women, predominantly Asian women. So what happens? You get the anti-Asian backlash that Trump helped to initiate by referring to the COVID-19 as the Chinese virus, giving it this title along the way. And so misogynistic violence has kind of morphed into, we also see this women playing this role of what some have called security moms, military wives who are there to support their husbands and their children. And yes, we want a strong man to back us. Then this morphs into what we have today, Moms for Liberty. The difference being Moms for Liberty is a well-financed so-called grassroots group. And they're going to rescue their children from all these left-wing educators in public schools that I personally keep looking for along the way. And lastly, the element of, when we get back to what I would call cultural racism, is the role evangelical Christians and their absolutism. There's just no question that they just have a long history of promoting whiteness, capitalism, misogyny against women, their connections with the Ku Klux Klan. Historically, women played a prominent role in that, with their children also, and the socialization that went on. And then the whole notion, evangelical Christians did not speak out against January 6th. They didn't like the violence, but they are not opposed to undermining democracy to get their one-way view out there. And all of this is spilled into intense anti-Semitism, which a recent study says that anti-Semitism hate crimes are at their highest level since started keeping data since 1979. So these things are going on right now around us. But if somebody just goes downtown to their local shopping mall, or walks through their neighborhoods, everything seems perfectly normal. And I think that's our real challenge, is to try to get the general public to see what is going on all around us.
Yes, that, I think that is the challenge, both in and outside of schools, and especially at the campus level, that the silence is kind of deafening. And not to discount those who are taking action, of course. I wanted to talk about Florida, because I think it's a really good example, and by good example, I mean bad example, of a lot of what you're describing in Florida. It's so clear we desperately need anti-fascist education, but part of fascism is attacking basic education as it stands. School libraries being wiped out, whole departments being gutted at the university level in Florida, basic topics that are part of primary education classrooms, like what is a family and families you can't talk about in Florida if you want to talk about all families. Black history, even history about the Holocaust, all these books you can't teach in the state. And then a totally hamstrung union in Florida, because DeSantis has been so aggressive in going after the union. I just wonder how you see what's going on in Florida to education and what the rest of the country should learn from this.
The attack on teacher unions, what DeSantis calls big unionism, I've yet to see a teacher union boss with a big cigar driving a big expensive car around, but that's the image, you know, and somehow they've got a grip on the schools, which is fantasy, but it's part of a larger anti-union movement that's gone on surely since the 1880s to the 1930s to our present moment, when we're seeing a rise of unions outside education and those battles going on. It's not just teacher unions, it's unions, it's labor rights that capital cannot stand. What's the biggest cost that capitalists want to eliminate? It's the labor costs. And so this is one area to control labor and to have a docile workforce. Teachers historically were expected to support the status quo and not rock the boat. It's not till the 1960s, the Supreme Court decision, that it's okay for a teacher to write a letter to their newspaper that criticizes their school administration or school board. So in some regards, this is recent history. With that in mind, one thing that why Florida is an interesting laboratory here is its own history. From the 1960s into the 1990s, their main graduation expectations were two, to have functional literacy and to teach how Americanism, in quotes, was preferable over communism. Americanism versus communism, and how America is a better place. It's this American exceptionalism. DeSantis walks into this history here. That might be 25 years ago when that ended, but who was behind all that? Big corporate money, the American Legion, the auxiliary of retired military folks, their push for Americanism, America first, going back to the racist trope of the 1930s, America first, and the mixing with the KKK there. And now we have a Republican since 2021, the far right, the American First Caucus, which details all these points, but also goes after public education as in a crisis. The censorship that's going on in public schools, using Florida as an example, is you had this anti-intellectualism in both Italy and Germany. And that led to a certain educational absolutism where there's no debating issues. There's one point of view and there's no debate. It goes against anything that we would think we would call critical thinking. And of course, there's no place for multiculturalism and looking at the differences that we have in society and learning from that. Along the way, that eliminates free speech. The other is the militaristic indoctrination of young people. I remind our teacher candidates that in the 1940s, the Supreme Court said, no, you don't have to say the Pledge of Allegiance in school. No, you don't have to bow down to patriotism. But that is a huge push within schools. So America first, Americanism. That's the underlying things to get into schools, to have this patriotic cadre. And, you know, the growth of junior ROTC, this military grooming, where we know now that in some school districts, children were forced into it against Pentagon rules. It's supposed to build character. Never mind the number of sexual assaults against especially young women who were in ROTC being groomed, junior ROTC in high schools, marching around in uniforms, all of this. The Nazis would have loved this. They would say, hey, this is good. This is good for America. So the fact that we do live in a militarized society where the Pentagon can give so-called surplus military weapons to school districts. I mean, we're talking bazookas, M16, M14 rifles, military equipment, millions of dollars to school districts. Los Angeles school district is just awash in these weaponry. Like, what for? They tend to go to low-income schools and schools of color. And that's where the recruiting is going on with junior ROTC and the like. That is one of my major concerns, is this militarization has been so normalized that to be patriotic, you have to support the military. We thank you for your service sort of thing. It really upsets me when I think, I'm sorry that that individual had to be in the military and do what he or she did. But can we just step back and see what's happening around the world right now with all our military bases around the world? When I bring up this point, people are surprised, oh yeah, we have all these bases around the world. Then I say, how many foreign military bases do we have in the United States? Well, of course, we have zero. It's inconceivable that the United States would have a foreign military base in the U.S. Yet it's accepted that we would do this around the world. And that's the nature of empire. Fascism is always expansive and wanting more territory and control. And neoliberal capitalism with austerity programs, austerity that wants to get rid of social services, is central to this current movement that's going on. Schools are just an easy site for the far right to latch onto right now and to ignore the basic needs of the larger population. Home security, food security, job security, income security, all of these issues are what the average citizen really is interested in, but that's not what's being talked about by the mainstream right now, as I see it.
To close out our conversation, I wanted to end with action. What do you hope that young people on the campuses, people at large, what can we do to sound the alarm and to mobilize people to act?
On the campuses, I would say, you know, with various identity groups, which I think are important to have safe places, those groups, I would hope, could expand beyond their groups and to reach out into the communities and start building stronger social movements and have the strength to do that, to align with other identity groups, for example, be it a trans group on campus, Black Student Caucus, for example, that they see, listen, we come from different positions, but overall we have similar goals. I'm thinking of a recent webinar I was doing with doctoral candidates at a college. And in the Q&A, a woman who's in central Pennsylvania identified, the questions they asked at the end of it, she goes, we're having at our high school a problem with racial slurs. Do you have any recommendations? Well, that's a huge one. That's only been going on for about 400 years, which I didn't say. My first comment was, well, you know, I wouldn't hold a general assembly to talk about it because that would probably backfire. She answers, it did. And that gave me pause. And I said, well, you need to start with your teachers. The teachers need to suspend their normal curriculum. You need big conversations. We need adults to be in the room. We need to talk the hard facts about race and racism. And also bringing up about misogynistic comments from male students going on. And I said, you know, you really need to zero in with these young people, these adolescents at the informative stage, and talk in classrooms in small groups. So that's, I would say, at the micro level of the school. I keep proposing that schools need to be zones of anti-fascism. And by zones of anti-fascism, it suggests, oh, wait, the school can't do it alone. You know, we can be shouting out the school windows and on the playground along the way. But no, I see those anti-fascist tentacles in an ideal world reaching out and going to that group in the community that's pursuing what we might call a liberal agenda, but might be able to be brought along. I see a networking is important right now. And the left needs to do that. They need to do the grassroots work, because we don't have big media. We don't have a good social media presence with lots of funding behind us. We don't have a major network like a Fox or an MSNBC or CNN. Well, what's the alternative? It's going to take grassroots work. In closing, I just want to go back and for us to remember the incredibly brave teachers in New York City's teacher union in the 1940s who said, we're speaking out against racism and anti-Semitism at a time when there was huge racism and anti-Semitism and support for the Nazis. You had teachers in the Deep South, if you can imagine, Black teachers and what was happening in the 1940s, then being able to speak out and beginning to frame their racism as part of fascism. So if teachers then could do it, under the real threats of death, I would hope that our teachers would not self-censor themselves and go, part of my teacher identity is not only serving my children, serving the families, but what that really means is serving that larger community. And I need to find ways to reach out. And I think that teachers' unions are the one vehicle that could serve that along the way.
Thank you so much, Michael, for coming and sharing your perspective, your expertise, and your time. We're going to link to the book in the show notes along with your website. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Sam, and Refuse Fascism for trying to get the word out there and your many beautiful and important broadcasts, especially around the anti-abortion issues. Really appreciate that. Thank you.
When I hear Dr. Vavris talk about the white anxiety rooted in slavery and the rising fascist absolutism that is transforming every institution in society, I wonder what it would look like if all of these same institutions did become, in fact, anti-fascist zones. Recently, I was on a large public college campus where one might never know what was going on in the world. That we are on a road to fascist consolidation, that 23 million women have been reduced to breeders and incubators, that over 500 anti-trans bills have been introduced or passed in recent months, that Biden and Putin are playing nuclear chicken. I saw a campus of 40,000 students in a stranglehold between what the revolutionary leader Babakian calls the two new outmoded's. The fascists on the one hand, and destructive, quote, woke identity politics on the other that tries to carve out safe spaces and dictate who can talk about what. Of course, the fascism is the more silencing and destructive force. But both of these frameworks are unhinged from reality and contributing to a situation where people are confused, demoralized, ignorant, and passive. Going back to Kathy's excellent questions from earlier, is it time to demonstrate in the streets outside our county GOP offices? Does anyone rally anymore? How do we throw a wrench into the fascist onslaught? And how do we find help in doing that? Collectively, we need to find answers to all of these questions. For regular listeners of this show, how do you take out the understanding that you get from Refuse Fascism to people to break the normalization and accommodation? What kinds of creative, bold actions, yes, outside of GOP offices, but all over the public square, can really puncture the air around this normalization and reset the terms in society? What kinds of conversations are you having at family gatherings? What kind of artwork or postering campaign could we get out all over town? And are you struggling with people in and out of power in our institutions to name this fascism and stand up to it? For my part, speaking for myself only and not everyone in Refuse Fascism, we need to plant a revolutionary pole, a pole of defiant resistance with the aim of overturning the system that has given rise to this fascism, the system of capitalism imperialism. Because I have to ask, what kind of country allows fascism to come to power? What kind of system puts the humanity of women or black people or LGBTQ people up to a vote by a Christian fascist supermajority? What kind of society keeps laughing at fascist lunatics amassing so much power instead of calling it a five-alarm fire and mobilizing everyone to fight this in every way possible? It is a dying, rotten system, and we are in a situation where radical change of one form or another is coming. Will it be radically reactionary and enslaving, with fascism consolidating, or will it be radically emancipating through a real revolution? For more on this, I recommend people check out the talk by Bob Avakian called Something Terrible or Something Truly Emancipating. Profound crisis, deepening divisions, the looming possibility of civil war, and the revolution that is urgently needed at revcom.us. And watch the weekly RNL Revolution Nothing Less show at youtube.com/therevcoms. Thanks for listening to Refuse Fascism. We want to hear from you. Share your thoughts, questions, ideas for topics or guests, or lend a skill. Tweet at Sam B. Goldman, or you can drop her a line at SamanthaGoldman@refusefascism.org. Or leave a voicemail by visiting anchor.fm/refuse-fascism and hitting the message button. Want to support the show? It's simple. Show us some love by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or your listening platform of choice. And of course, follow, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Become a patron to support our pod and content creation to help people understand and act to stop the fascist threat. For as little as $2 a month, you can help make a difference in producing and promoting this independent weekly podcast. Give today at patreon.com/refusefascism or make a one-time contribution by visiting refusefascism.org and hitting the donate button. Thanks to Sam Goldman, Richie Marini, Lena Thorne, and Mark Tinkelman for helping produce this episode. Thanks to incredible volunteers, we have transcripts available for each episode, so be sure to visit refusefascism.org and sign up to get them in your inbox. We'll be back next Sunday. Until then, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.